kingdom. Okay, now if we go back to the previous slide here, I gave you my conclusion, but much of this conclusion is based on material we haven't taught yet, okay? So the next thing I want to talk about is the idea is about what non-Christians had to say about Jesus, and then what Christians had to say about Jesus, okay? So in other words, you and I believe that the Bible is inspired by God and things that says happened, okay? But to some people, if you pull out the Bible, they'll automatically say circular reasoning. You know, you're trying to use the Bible to prove the Bible, which, by the way, I believe absolutely you can use the Bible to prove the Bible, all right? But some people will not have that conversation. So I think it's good to ask them to consider some of the sources. There are seven Roman authors, 2 Jewish authors, and 33 Christian authors from roughly 30 AD to, say, about 150 AD. Past 150 AD, I think what somebody says would be obviously a secondary source and not of much value. Okay? Now, I had all of the Roman sources in the first version, but it's a little bit repetitive, so I'm not going to show you all of them. I'll just show you a few of them. All right, so this is Tacitus. I don't know if we really need to read the whole thing here, but he tells us about Nero, and that Nero blamed these people called Christians. So apparently there were Christians at the end of the first century. It says a group hated for their crimes, and he said they took their name from a person called Christ. Right. I think that's probably the same guy that we're talking about, right? And it says who during the reign of Tiberius was executed by Pontius Pilate. So we have an external source that says there is a person who lived at this time. He was executed, we know by who, and et cetera, okay? The movement was suppressed, but it keeps breaking out, and there are all kinds of stuff happening, okay? So we don't know a lot about Christianity, but we know it existed. We know that it was founded by an actual person who actually lived. We know how he died. We know who killed him and when he was killed. Okay, then there's Josephus. Now, the passage from Josephus, unfortunately, is a little bit controversial. And the reason is, the Greek version we have, there's evidence of interpolation. Now, that's a big word, interpolation. I'm sorry, big word. Interpolation means somebody added to the original. All right? However, we have an Arabic version which doesn't have the additional material. So we can pretty easily determine what Josephus actually wrote. And we know Josephus wrote. He was a Jewish author who basically worked for the emperor. All right. He worked for Titus and Vespasian. All right. And so I'm going to read it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the part without the yellow, which is what Josephus wrote. About this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, for he was one who wrought surprising feats and was a teacher of such people as accept the truth. He won over many Jews and many Greeks. When Pilate, upon hearing him accused by men of the highest standing among us, had condemned him to be crucified, those who had in the first place come to love him did not give up their affection for him. For the prophets of God had prophesied these and countless other marvelous things about him, and the tribe of Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared. And if you think about this, the yellow stuff, it's not something that an unbeliever would say. It doesn't make sense. But an unbeliever would say those other things. So what do we know from a Jewish person who did not believe in Jesus, who was not a Christian, and had no reason to lie? We learned that there was a person named Jesus, that he was crucified, that the people believed he worked miracles. I don't think he's saying he did work miracles. He's saying that people believed he worked miracles. And that it was believed that he fulfilled many of the prophecies of Messiah. Okay? The Talmud, which is Jewish writings, these are commentaries about the Old Testament. Certainly not Christians. Are you kidding? They hated Christians. They hated Christianity. They hated everything about Christianity. But they did mention Jesus. They called him Yeshu. You see that? Yeshu. They said they hung him. All right. It doesn't say crucify, but hung is consistent with crucify. And Josephus said crucify. All right. They said that he was accused of witchcraft. And so you can see that they're acknowledging that he worked miracles. Okay? But they're claiming those miracles were done by demons. Which is consistent with the New Testament statements that the Jews said his miracles were being done by demons. So that tells us it was common knowledge, even to the enemies of Christianity, that Jesus worked miracles. Okay? All right. Anyway, that's enough on that. Suetonius. He said, as the Jews were making constant disturbance at the instigation of Crestus, all right, that's Jesus, they were expelled from Rome. So I was just talking about the expulsion from Rome that was mentioned in the book of Acts. Mm. And it's basically the Christians were the cause of that problem. Lucian of Samosata, who says he was crucified. He called him a crucified sage. And he says the Christians had contempt of death. He said, you could tell the Christians we'll kill you if you don't change your mind. And they had no fear of death whatsoever. What this tells me, without any doubt, is they believed he was raised from the dead. Now, whether he was raised from the dead, we'll talk about that later on. But it's a historical fact that Christians existed, that they taught Jesus fulfilled the prophecies of the Messiah. They didn't just teach that he worked miracles, they believed that he worked miracles. All right, and they believed he was raised from the dead. All these are historical fact established outside of Christians. And the whole idea that the idea of Jesus is a myth is proved completely, utterly wrong by these things. Okay, Pliny, who was asking, what should I do with these Christians? Should I kill them or not? All right, those who denied they were or had been Christians invoked the words of the gods, offered a prayer with incense. We let them go. So we know by already the very beginning of the second century what the Bible tells us, which is Domitian made Christianity illegal, that it was in fact illegal, and they had to offer incense and give a prayer to God and all that. And he said some would do it, and we let them go. All right, but he says none of those are real Christians. See, even he knows the difference between a real Christian and a fake Christian, all right? That no Christian would deny Jesus. Those I thought should be discharged. Others, named by the informer, declared that they were Christians. And basically, he said, what should I do? Should I kill these people or not? Okay, this is an interesting one. This guy, Thallus, who was writing the year 50 AD, 20 years after the resurrection. And he's discussing the claim of darkness at the time of Jesus' death. He mentions that. This is not a Christian. So apparently the idea that the darkness happened at the time of death was common knowledge at the time. He didn't deny it. He said it was due to an eclipse. So we have clear evidence of a miraculous darkness. At the time of Jesus' death, he claims it was an eclipse. But we know it was not an eclipse. Because all the solar and lunar eclipses that have happened for the last 50,000 years, we know when they happen and where they happen. So isn't that interesting? We have clear evidence for a miracle at the time of Jesus' death. Okay? Got it? By the way, the guy who quotes in this guy, Africana, says Thales is wrong. Anyway. Now, let's talk about the Christians who wrote about Jesus. You know, I find it interesting that these skeptics of Christianity, they ignore every Christian who ever said anything about Jesus as if their testimony is invalid. They don't treat anybody else like this. Anybody who's not a Christian, they could say whatever they want, and they treat it as if it's the gospel truth. But when a Christian says, this is what happened, they say, oh, you can't trust it. And my question is, why not? Is there something about these people that tells you they're liars? Well, we know from the testimony of these other people that you could ask them to deny Jesus, and they had no fear of death. I would claim these Christians were the most reliable, honest witnesses, perhaps in all history. And yet people just ignore them as if their testimony is of no consequence at all, which is not logical, it's not reasonable, it's not how they treat any other witnesses. So we can see this guy Papias, who wrote in probably the last decade of the first century. And he said, if by chance anyone who had been in attendance on the elders should come my way, I inquired about the words of the elders, that is, what according to the elders Andrew or Peter said, or Philip or Thomas or James or John. In other words, he said, I talked to dozens and dozens of people who personally spoke with Peter and James and John. So this person is making it up, you know, this guy is not reliable. You got to give me a reason to believe that he didn't know what he's talking about. So when Papias tells us what Jesus did, as he does in great detail, to call him a liar, we need a rational reason to reject this. Bottom line is, I believe the New Testament witnesses to be reliable in detail. And I'm going to give you more reasons for that. Okay, this is Quadratus. He wrote in the second decade of the second century. The works of our Savior were always present. They were genuine. And those, he's talking about the healings, those who were raised from the dead. He said these people were walking around. We could talk to them. When they were raised, they were also always present, not merely while the Savior was on earth, but after his death, they were alive for quite a while. You know, people say, you know, the Gospels were written so long after Jesus lived, but you can't really trust them, what they say. Now, wait a minute. Takeshi, when was the church planted here in Tokyo?
1988.
So 30 years ago. That was 30 years ago. How do we know it even got planted? You see, people argue that the people who wrote the New Testament, it had happened so long ago, so nobody could really know what actually happened. This is ridiculous. You know, Paul says in Corinthians, which was probably written in 54 A.D., 54 A.D., that's like yesterday. He said there were more than 500 eyewitnesses. If you don't believe, ask them. And I don't know, of the 500 eyewitnesses, how many of them were still alive 24 years later? Probably most of them. And so the idea that Matthew could make up a gospel and, all right, for example, 30 pieces of silver, the idea that he could make that up, because the people who paid 30 pieces of silver were still alive when Matthew wrote his gospel? All of them? No, but most of them. So see, what liars do is they give as few details as possible. But the New Testament writers do the exact opposite. They give the smallest little detail. And that's kind of what Paul's doing in 1 Corinthians 15. He's saying, if you don't believe it, just ask them. And I'll tell you, every single one of them was under the constant threat of death. And none of them ever changed their testimony. There's no evidence that a single one ever changed their testimony. I think that's powerful evidence. You know, consider those who were killed. We know that James was killed because that's recorded by Josephus. We know the brother of John, James, was killed because Luke, who, by the way, is one of the most accurate historians of the ancient world, says it. And the evidence that Peter and Paul were killed is, it's almost like a slam dunk. You know, the evidence of how the other apostles died, honestly, is a little shaky. How Thomas died, whether he went to India, these things. These are not particularly reliable accounts, honestly. But the martyrdoms of the two Jameses, I believe, is very, very solid. The martyrdoms of Peter and Paul are very solid. In fact, probably Paul's body is underneath St. Paul's Cathedral in Rome. Because that site was known from the 3rd century. Right? Traditionally, all the apostles but John were killed for their faith. Now, if this was a lie, if this was a myth, if, for example, the writers of the gospel say Jesus claimed to be God. People say, oh, he doesn't claim to be God. All right, well then, but they said it. And they were all killed for their faith. Now, let's compare this to, say, for example, Mormonism. If you read the Book of Mormon, in the front of the Book of Mormon has these three eyewitnesses who saw the golden plates. Okay, all three of them left Mormonism. That's a great witness, you know. And later on, there were the eight witnesses that attested to the fact that he's a prophet. And I don't think all eight of them left. I think something like six out of the eight left Mormonism, something like that. Wow, that's really solid stuff. But I would say, from what we know, even from the sources external to the Bible, which I admit, we don't have a huge amount of material. By the way, did you know we have as many sources about Jesus as we do about Tiberius? King Tiberius, you know, the one there. We have exactly, or within plus or minus one, exactly as many ancient writers mentioned Tiberius as mentioned Jesus. Does anybody question whether Tiberius lived and how he was born and how he died? Suetonius wrote about him, and we assume what Suetonius said happened is what really happened. But people say, oh no, Jesus didn't really raise Lazarus from the dead. He didn't really walk on water. He didn't really feed the 5,000. The bias of these people is so obvious. And so we should not be intimidated. We should tell our Christians this. That the New Testament is reliable, accurate history. All right, so reasons to believe the gospel writers are reliable. There's the embarrassment factor. You know, if they were making up a story, would their greatest hero be an idiot? You know? Would their greatest hero deny Jesus three times and tell him to not, you know? In the Gospels, the apostles are made to look really quite bad many, many times. And so it just feels like a genuine story. And if you read other writings from ancient times, they don't feel like this. Another thing I think is really important is we have to understand that these four Gospels and Acts were written when most of the people who saw the original events were still alive. And the idea that these main leaders of this religion could put lies in their scriptures, and the people would say, that's fine. You know, I'm just telling you, these skeptics believe all these things I'm talking about, and it's crazy. And so when you read these things by these skeptics, you got to realize these people are, they're very far off, you know? For example, the book of Galatians was written roughly 49 AD. That's less than 20 years after Jesus was killed. 1 Corinthians in 55 AD. Mark probably by 60 AD. Maybe even as early as 50 AD. Luke probably around 64 or 65 AD. And I'm going to talk, not today, but I think it's tomorrow night, about the reliability of the scriptures and the idea that there's supposedly all these contradictions. And, you know, we have four different Gospels, and they give clearly a very different perspective. And yet, they don't contradict. I don't care what people say, it's a fact that they don't contradict. And then there's the reliability of Luke. Luke is a historian of great care. Luke was very, very careful, and we'll see about that. So can you believe Luke as an historian? You know, in Luke's gospel, he mentions the names of several people. And what he's trying to do is he's trying to establish his sources. He's trying to write not just an orderly account, but an orderly account that's clearly connected to facts of history that his readers were aware of. You know, they used to say, because Luke said that Jesus was crucified by Pontius Pilate in the time of Tiberius, and that Pilate was procured of Judea. And the skeptics, they deny everything. They say, unless you can prove it's true, we say it's not true, which is not a very good standard, honestly, all right? And so they said, there's no evidence there was a guy named Pontius Pilate, none at all. There's no evidence that Pontius Pilate was procurator of Judea. And then they found this inscription in Caesarea, which says, Tiberius, who's, you know, Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judea. All right, there you go. And the thing is, the skeptics will only concede the things they absolutely have to concede. That's what they do. And what they don't notice is how foolish that makes them look, because they say, we're sure about this. Well, okay, never mind. And they never change their opinion, you know? They just never seem to change their opinion. Here's what Ramsey said. Now, Ramsey was a famous historian. In fact, he was the most well-known biblical archaeologist of his day. The leading biblical archaeologist of his day. But he was very, very skeptical. He believed Jesus was a real person, but he doubted the Gospels. He believed Luke was a created account, not reliable. And then he spent the next 30 or 40 years, and this is his conclusion. He said, I found myself brought into contact with the book of Acts as an authority for the topography, the antiquities, and the society of Asia Minor. In other words, he said, basically what he says is, as a historian, I found Luke to be perhaps the most reliable source of any of the sources. Not only is he reliable, he's more reliable. For example, I'm going out of order here, but there's one important leader, I can't remember which one, and Luke says he was, I don't know, like a tetrarch or something. And Cicero said he was something else. And then they found an inscription. Guess who was right, Cicero or Luke? Luke was always right. Because, you know, people think Cicero is pretty awesome, but Cicero was not careful. Luke was careful. Anyway, it was gradually borne upon me that in various details the narrative showed marvelous truth. In fact, beginning with a fixed idea that the work was essentially a second century composition. In other words, he believed the person Luke was not even a real person. This was just a fiction created 100 years later. And never relying on its evidence as trustworthy for the first century conditions, I gradually came to find it a useful ally. Now look at this. Luke is an historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, he's possessed of the true historic sense. He fixes his mind on the idea and plan that rules in the evolution of history, proportions the scale of his treatment to the importance of the incident, etc., etc., etc. So there you go. And people say, oh, you can't believe anything Luke said. All right, well. Erastus, not a real person. And then in Corinth, they found an inscription talking about Erastus. Erastus. And he's the same guy. There's almost no doubt he's the same guy. Lysanias. That's Luke chapter 3, verse 1. Lysanias. All right, Lysanias the Tetrarch. He's a real guy. Here's the Pool of Siloam. Here's the bone box of Caiaphas, the high priest. He was a real guy. Here is an ankle bone through which a nail was driven. So apparently, crucifixion by driving nails through the feet was that actually happened. Okay? Now, the next thing I'm going to talk about is messianic prophecies. If I keep going, it'll be another half hour, and then we take lunch, or we take lunch and then sort of keep going, and then.
Yeah.
Okay, sure. Now, I love doing this one. Yeah, in San Diego, we created a Bible study series called the Jesus series. I don't know if you've seen it. It's the one I use. Not everybody in San Diego uses it. But basically, we use Acts chapter 2 to organize the whole study series. In our first study, we go through messianic prophecies and miracles. I was studying with a guy who was kind of like a Buddhist guy. Didn't believe in Jesus. Basically, he thought Jesus was like, you know, a wise person, kind of like, you know, Christian or whatever. We did this study, and he's like, I need to become a Christian, you know. So I think this kind of material, I think our young Christians need this kind of basic stuff. So I want to talk about messianic prophecies. And I believe anybody who can read the prophecies in the Old Testament about the Messiah and can deny that Jesus is the Messiah, I think they need to go back to maybe learn how to think, learn how to read, learn how to, common sense logic. Now, that's kind of a strong statement, but seriously. So anyway, we already read John 5:39-40, but Jesus said, this is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that was written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms. So again, he's making the claim the Bible's written about him. By the way, the three divisions of the Jewish Bible were the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms. So basically he says, you know, basically I'm not quite done yet because some of the prophecies about me have not yet been fulfilled. So he's explaining to his followers why he was doing what he was doing. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the prophecies of the Messiah. We're going to ask, all right, what does this imply? Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to purposely try to take the skeptic's perspective. All right. By the way, I did a debate about whether God exists about 4 years ago, and I lost the debate. I was trounced. And the reason was I took the position that God doesn't exist. Okay? And my opponent was a very, very smart high school senior who was about to go to Berkeley. He graduated number one in his class. But I'm telling you, when I debated that God doesn't exist, I played it really straight. I'm telling you, I did a pretty good job. You know, I was not joking, ha ha ha. I mean, so when I finished, because I went first, and when I finished, this was teenagers. They were like, oh, you know. And then my friend went, and he did a good job. At the end, they were like, that's interesting. But then we did the rebuttal part. And then in the rebuttal, it was so obvious that everything I said was just a bunch of rhetoric. And I had no answers to any of his points at all. And his answers to my points were like, oh, okay, sure enough. But my point is that we should be able to carefully argue the other side, you know. If you're going to debate with somebody, you need to understand the questions that the skeptics are going to bring up. You should know. You should read their books. Don't worry. You can read Bart Ehrman, and you won't lose your faith. All right. Don't give Bart Ehrman's books to a baby Christian. Bad idea. But you can read that stuff. I don't know if you know who Bart Ehrman is, but anyway. So, question number one: how do I know these things were really written well ahead of time? How do I know that? Okay? So, for example, maybe it was written well after the fact. Okay? But, of course, that doesn't make any sense because we have the Septuagint translation of the Old Testament from roughly 200 BC. The entire Old Testament was translated from Hebrew or Aramaic into Greek in 200 BC. All right, so clearly, no, this was, and also we have the Dead Sea Scrolls. All right, we have actual physical manuscripts from as much as 250 years before Christ. So the idea that this was written afterward is just not true. All right, skeptic, all right, well, fine. Next thing. And by the way, there's one of the caves. They found more scrolls in this cave than in the other. It's kind of cool. There's the Isaiah scroll from 150 BC. Yes, Isaiah 53 was definitely written before Jesus. All right. Number two. But how do I know these things really happened? All right. Now, I've already said the reasons to believe the witnesses are pretty good. But let's take the skeptic's perspective and say, all right, we'll wipe out anything. Never mind that Luke was an accurate historian. Never mind that these people would die without changing their story. Never mind their character, because the people describe the Christians as the most honest, trustworthy people in the entire empire. Never mind all that. All right, even if we just allow the facts from outside of Christian writers, almost all the prophecies we're going to look at, their fulfillment are a matter of historical fact, even outside of the Bible. Now, I'm not going to go through these readings because we already did this, okay? All right, so. Number three. How do you know this was really a prophecy about the Messiah? You know, maybe they're... Remember I talked about cherry picking? Maybe they're cherry picking. You know, maybe it says that, I don't know, blah, 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 rode on a donkey, blah, blah, blah. And it's just a story about a guy who rode on a donkey. You know, how do we know that? How do we know these are really prophecies of the Messiah? Now, we're going to look at about seven or eight prophecies. All but one of them, the Jews all along had said, these are prophecies about our Messiah. One of them, not, by the way. I'll tell you about that one. So, if the Jews said it was about their Messiah long before Jesus was born, then I'd say that question is answered. Okay, next. Maybe, they're trying to spin a scenario by which they can ignore these things. That's what they're doing. So, maybe Jesus says, all right, great, I want to be proclaimed the Messiah. Okay, I got to ride into Jerusalem on a donkey. All right, check. In fact, the Gospels even say that Jesus had them put the donkey aside because he knew about the prophecy. So maybe that's what it is. Jesus says, all right, I got to do this. Great. I just check, check, check. But there's a problem with that. Because if you want to have everybody worship you and have a religion, the prophecies involve you getting killed, all right? And, you know, that's not a really great plan. I'm going to fulfill all these prophecies so everybody will say how great I am, you know? This really doesn't make much sense. And besides, we're going to see some of these prophecies, it was literally impossible for him to arrange it. For example, where he was born, stuff like that. All right, so let's look at the prophecies. Again, this is not new material, everybody. This is not new material. But just try to imagine presenting this to non-Christians. And to your high school students, your college students, they need to see this stuff because they're bombarded. And don't assume that they fully believe what they say they believe. Don't assume that. Don't assume that because they have unresolved questions. I guarantee you. I guarantee you. Anyway, so it says in Isaiah 53, by the way, is this a messianic prophecy? Well, the Jews said so. In Qumran, the Qumran people's community said it was, so I guess so. It says he was despised and rejected by men. Now, is that a historical fact? Despised and rejected? Is that a historical fact?
Yeah.
Could Jesus have arranged to be despised and rejected? Yeah. Like you say to the... to the Pharisees, you're a bunch of whitewashed tombs of brood of vipers. Yeah, that'll get all right. Good. Now, pierced for our transgressions. Pierced for our transgressions. Now, I'll admit the crucifixion is a historical fact outside the Bible. The fact that he was also pierced, I will admit, I other than biblical sources, I can't prove to you. But then again, most of the eyewitnesses were non-Christians. Yeah. And it's not like when John wrote his gospel, he said, well, no, that didn't really happen. All right? Now, could Jesus have arranged to be pierced? Well, I guess so. I imagine him on the cross. Hey, guys, you know, you already crucified me. You've really been mean to me. Can you do me a favor? Hey, my friends, they'll give you 5,000 yen afterward if you do this. Just do me a favor, please. After I die, would you please pierce me with a sword? You know, that's kind of silly. It said he was oppressed and afflicted and did not open his mouth. And really, given the charges against Jesus, if he defended himself, he certainly never would have been executed. Could he have read Isaiah and said, all right, that's what I'm going to do? I suppose. Okay, next. All right. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel. This is certainly a messianic prophecy. The Messiah will be born in Bethlehem. There are two different towns called Bethlehem in Israel, by the way. The smaller one is Bethlehem Ephrathah. That's where Jesus was born. Historical fact. Could Jesus arrange to be born in Bethlehem? I don't think so, unless he's God. But that's, you know. Here's an interesting note. Isaiah 9, verse 1. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and Naphtali. But in the future, he'll honor Galilee of the Gentiles by way of the sea. For us, to us a child is born. He'll be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. If there was ever a messianic prophecy, this is one of them. Let me show you where Zebulun and Naphtali are. Here's Zebulun, and here's Naphtali. Let me show you where Nazareth is. Right there. Right at the border of Zebulun and Naphtali. Right? Now, if you want to claim to be the Messiah, you have to get born in Bethlehem. But you have to actually come from the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. I would say of the 7 billion people living today, probably there's less than 20 who would be qualified. But you also, by the way, have to be despised and rejected and pierced and silent when accused. Okay, good. The next one is Psalm 22. Now, remember I told you all the prophecies I'm using are obviously messianic. Because the Jews who reject Jesus will say they're messianic. This is the one exception. This is not, the Jews would not say this is messianic. But it says, a band of evil men have encircled me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They stare and gloat over me. They debarred my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. Now, it is a historical fact that Jesus was crucified. Now, I imagine David writing this one. Imagine David writing this psalm. He says, they pierced my hands and my feet. Why did I say that? I mean, they divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. Did that ever happen to David? I mean, I believe this is about the Messiah. Now, if you want to reject this because it's not obviously a messianic prophecy, feel free.
Yeah.
But did you know that crucifixion wasn't even invented until 300 BC by the Persians? So when David lived, piercing of hands and feet was something that never happened. And actually, piercing of hands and feet, the Persians did it differently. Piercing of hands and feet was invented by the Romans in roughly 100 BC, 900 years after this was written. And then it says, they divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. Now, I admit, for this, we only have Bible witnesses on this. But which did they do? Did they divide or gamble? Which did they do? Okay, well, according to John, first they divided, and then they gambled. Could Jesus have arranged this? Could Jesus have arranged to be crucified? Turns out, getting crucified was very difficult. Because the Jews couldn't crucify you. In order to get somebody crucified, you had to get the Romans to do the execution. All right, so even that is surprising. But so I imagine Jesus on the cross. Hey guys, you know that inner garment? That one's of one piece. It's really valuable. If I were you, I would gamble for it. All right, pretty silly. Okay, how about this one? Zechariah 11. If you think it best, give me my pay. By the way, the one speaking here in context is God. So this is a messianic prophecy. If you think it best, give me my pay, but if not, keep it. So they paid me 30 pieces of silver. All right. And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, the handsome price at which they priced me. By the way, this is the betrayer speaking, but this one here, me, right, that is God speaking. In other words, God says, I was betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. Now, how much was Judas paid? 30 pieces of silver. You sure it's not 40? I mean, how do we really know that it was 30 pieces of silver? Because liars don't give details that can't be checked out. You know what I'm saying? Liars give you as little information as they can. You know, I like to imagine, you know, the ones who actually set the price at 30 pieces? I like to imagine them, you know, a few months later reading Zechariah saying, oh, man, should have given him 100 pieces of silver. Man. By the way, what did Judas do with the money? Threw it back, and they used the money to buy a potter's field, prophesied more than 500 years before the event. Much of this, a matter of historical fact. Much of it, Jesus wasn't even in the room for the 30 pieces, so he certainly did not arrange this one. Are you kidding? I really like the fact that God used Jesus' enemies to fulfill the prophecies. I find that kind of nice. Okay, our last one, Daniel 9, 24 through 26. 77s are decreed for your people and your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision of prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. No one understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and build Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there'll be seven sevens and 62 sevens. Now, if there was ever an obvious messianic prophecy, it's certainly this one, because the word Messiah is in this passage, the anoint. That's the word Messiah. And it says that he's going to come to Jerusalem. He's going to seal up prophecy, bring in everlasting righteousness, atone for sin. And it's going to be, let me see, 70 sevens from the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Now, do we have a record of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem? Well, we have the decree of Cyrus from 538 BC, and he said, go back and build the temple. Not the city, the temple. Then, and that's in Ezra chapter 1. Then we have the decree of Darius, who said, hey, finish building the temple. That's from 520 BC. That's also in Ezra. But in Ezra chapter 7, we have the decree of Artaxerxes. And we know that he said to go back and rebuild the city because that's exactly what they did. That because we have the record in Nehemiah. And that was given in the seventh year of Artaxerxes, which is 458 BC. Okay? So if you subtract 70 sevens, that's 490. And by the way, the reason we know these 70 sevens are years is because if you read Daniel 9, he says 70 years. He says the prophecy was 70 years, and God says, no, 7 times 70 years. That's when I'm going to save you. So these are years. All right, and so 458 minus 490 is negative 32. That's 32 AD. No, 33 AD. Because there was no year zero. Now, if you read the prophecy carefully, it says seven sevens and 62 sevens. So what it actually says is during the final week. The prophecy says during the final week. So in other words, sometime between 26 and 33 AD. And Jesus was killed in 30 AD. Now, in order to be the Messiah, you have to be killed in Jerusalem somewhere between 26 and 33 AD. All right? So if anybody were to claim to be the Messiah today, they're mistaken. And Jews who say, oh, we're still waiting for the Messiah, should probably read their scripture a little bit more carefully. Okay? All right. So if you want to claim to be the Messiah, you have to be born in Bethlehem. You have to actually come, though, from Galilee, in the area somewhere near Nazareth. You have to be despised and rejected. You have to be silent when accused. You have to be pierced and crucified. You have to be have your garments gambled over and divided. Have to get betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, and the money needs to do something about a potter or something like that. And also, the kicker is you have to come to Jerusalem, and this crucifixion needs to happen sometime around 30 AD. All right? So those who say Jesus is not the Messiah, I think they probably haven't read this material. And by the way, here's what the skeptics do, because a lot of skeptics, they don't read the Bible, they don't know anything about it, they read websites, but there are some skeptics who do actually read the Bible. Now, they read it so they can prove it's not true. So here's what they do. What they want to do is they want to take each one of the prophecies and treat them as if it's a complete isolated case, which it's not, and then they want to undermine that one. For example, they'll say the prophecy in Isaiah 7 is about a king that was during that time. By the way, that's actually true. It's actually a prophecy of what God did then and what did later. And then what they do with Psalm 22 is they say, you know where it says pierced? That Hebrew word also means camel. So they've cameled my hands and my feet. You know. So what they do is they refuse. You will never ever get any skeptic to do this whole study with. If they just walk out of the room or you know whatever. And so they want to divide and conquer, which doesn't make any sense. But I would say if you look at the whole case, if you don't believe Jesus is the Messiah, then what planet are you living on? I'm serious. So I think we should use this evidence here in Japan. Oh my goodness. Get your friends. Pay them, you know. Give them a special food. You know, pay many, many yen and get them to come and listen to this presentation. You know, how could they deny it? Of course, remember, they saw Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead and they decided to kill him. So why is that? Well, because he was a threat to their way of life. And Jesus is a threat to the Japanese way of life. I get that. All right, there are many other messianic prophecies. We won't talk about those. Although it's kind of fun. All right. Here's a fun one. In Matthew 2:23, it says that he came from Nazareth. And he says that was prophesied. The skeptics say, there's no prophecy that the Messiah would be from Nazareth. But what they ignore is in Isaiah 11 and also in Ezekiel and in Jeremiah, it calls the Messiah Branch. It's a branch. He's called Branch. It's like his nickname in the Old Testament. Messiah's called Branch, Branch of Jesse. And you know what the word branch is? It's Nazar. And so Jesus was born in a town called Branch. So the prophecy is he will be called Branch. And they literally called him Branch because Jesus was called the Nazarene. So he fulfilled that prophecy. And by the way, Matthew does know what he's talking about. It's the skeptics who don't know what they're talking about. All right, I'd say that's a sufficient time. I promised you another half hour, and that's a half hour. So we'll take a break, and we'll do some more evidence.
Okay, great. Thank you.